This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Uncommon Type, Some Stories. This is the author, Tom Hanks. Three exhausting weeks. Day one. Anna said there was only one place to find a meaningful gift for M-Dash, the antique warehouse, not so much a place for old treasures as a permanent swap meet in what used to be the Lux Theater, before HBO, Netflix, and the 107 other entertainment outlets bankrupted the Lux. I sat for many hours in that once splendid cinema palace and watched movies. Now it's stall after stall of what passes for antiques. Anna and I looked into every one of them. M-Dash was about to become a naturalized U.S. citizen, which was as big a deal for us as it was for him. Steve Wong's grandparents were naturalized in the 40s. My dad had escaped the low-grade thugs that were East European communists in the 1970s. And, way back when, Anna's ancestors rode boats across the North Atlantic, seeking to pillage whatever was pillageable in the New World. The Anna family legend is that they found Martha's Vineyard. Mohammed Dayax Abdo was soon to be as American as Abdo Pie, so we wanted to get him something vintage, an objet de patriotique that would carry the heritage and humor of his new country. I thought the old radio flyer wagon in the second warehouse stall was perfect. When he has American kids, he'll pass that wagon on to them, I said. But Anna was not about to purchase the first antique we came across, so we kept on hunting. I bought a 48-star American flag from the 1940s. The flag would remind M-Dash that his adoptive nation is never finished building itself, that good citizens have a place somewhere in her fruited plain, just as more stars can fit in the blue field above those red and white stripes. Anna approved, but kept searching, seeking a present that would be far more special. She wanted unique, nothing less than one of a kind. After 3 hours, she decided the radio flyer was a good idea after all. Rain started falling just as we were pulling out of the parking lot in my VW bus. We had to drive slowly back to my house because my wiper blades are so old they left streaks on the windshield. The storm went on well into the evening, so rather than drive home, Anna hung around, played my mother's old mixtapes, which I'd converted to CDs, cracking up over Mom's eclectic taste, in the segues from the Pretenders to the OJs to Taj Mahal. When Iggy Pop's Real Wild Child came on, she asked, "Do you have any music from the last 20 years? I made pulled pork burritos. She drank wine. I drank beer. She started a fire in my Franklin stove, saying she felt like a pioneer woman on the prairie. We sat on my couch as night fell, the only lights being the fire and the audio levels on my sound system bounding from green to orange and occasionally red. Distant sheet lightning flashed in the storm miles and miles away. You know what, she said to me? It's Sunday. I do know that, I told her. I live in the moment. I admire that about you, smart, caring, easygoing, to the point of sloth. You've gone from compliments to insults. Change sloth to languorousness, she said, sipping wine. Point is, I like you. I like you, too. I wondered if this conversation was going someplace. Are you flirting with me? No, Anna said. I'm propositioning you. Totally different thing. Flirting is fishing. Maybe you hook up, maybe you don't. Propositioning is the first step in closing a deal. Understand that Anna and I have known each other since high school. St. Anthony Country Day. Go Crusaders! We didn't date, but hung out in the same crowd and liked each other. After a few years of college and a few more of taking care of my mom, I got my license and pretended to make a living in real estate for a while. One day, she walked into my office because she needed to rent a space for her graphics business, and I was the only agent she could trust because I once dated a friend of hers and was not a jerk when we broke up. Anna was still very pretty. She never lost her lean, rope-taut body of a triathlete, which in fact she had been. For a day, I showed her some available spaces, none of which she wanted for reasons that made little sense to me. I could tell she was still just as driven, focused, and tightly wound as she had been at SACD. She had too keen an eye for the smallest of details and left no stones unturned, uninspected, unrecorded, or unreplaced if they needed replacing. Adult Anna was exhausting. Adult Anna was no more my type than teen Anna had been. Funny, then, that she and I became such solid friends, much closer than when we were kids. I am one of those lazy butt loners who can poke my way through a day and never feel a second has been wasted. In fact, as soon as I sold my mom's house and parked the money in investments, I walked away from my fake business and settled into the best life imaginable. Give me a few loads of laundry to do and a hockey game on the NHL channel, and I'm good for an entire afternoon. In the time I spend lollygagging over my whites and colors, Anna will drywall her attic, prepare her taxes, make her own fresh pasta, and start up a clothing exchange on the Internet. She sleeps and fits and starts from midnight to dawn and has the energy to go full throttle all day. I sleep dead to the world as long as possible and take a nap every day at 2:30 p.m. I'm going to kiss you now. Anna did, just as she said. We had never done that, other than those pecks on cheeks that go with brief hugs. That night, she was offering a whole new version of herself, and I tensed up, confused. "Hey, relax," she whispered. Her arms were around my neck. She smelled damn good and tasted of wine. "It's the Sabbath, a day of rest. This is not going to be work." We kissed again, this time with me a collected and invested participant. My arms went around her and pulled her close. We leaned into each other and loosened up. We found each other's necks and worked our way back to our mouths. I had not kissed a woman like that in close to a year, not since the evil girlfriend Mona not only dumped me but stole cash from my billfold. Mona had problems, but kissing? She was fabulous. "Atta baby," Anna sighed. "Shabbat shalom," I sighed back. "We should have done that years ago." "I think we could use some time spent skin on skin," Anna whispered. "Take off your clothes." I did. When she took off hers, I was a goner. Day 2. My Monday morning breakfast was buckwheat pancakes, chorizo sausage, a huge bowl of berries, and percolated coffee. Anna opted for some herbal tea I had long ago tucked away in the pantry and a tiny bowl of nuts she chopped up with a cleaver. She counted out 8 blueberries to round out her nutritious breakfast. I shouldn't say that neither of us wore clothes as we ate, as it would make us sound like nudists, but the fact is we tumbled out of bed without the slightest inhibitions. As she was getting dressed for work, she told me we were signing up for scuba diving lessons. "We are?" I asked her. "Yep, we are going to get certified," she said. "And you need to get some workout clothes, running shoes and sweats. Go to the Foot Locker in the Arden Mall. Meet me for lunch at my office right after. Bring the wagon and the flag for M-Dash. We'll wrap them." "Okay," I said. "I'll make dinner at my place tonight. We'll watch a documentary. Then we are going to do in my bed what we spent last night doing in yours."
"Okay," I repeated.
Day 3. Anna ended up taking me to Foot Locker, making me try on 5 different pairs of shoes. We settled on cross trainers, and 4 versions of sweatpants and tops, Nike. Then we bought food and drinks for the party Anna wanted to throw for M-Dash. She said my house was the only place for such a bash. Around noon, M-Dash was one of 1,600 soon-to-be Americans standing on the floor of the sports arena, right hands raised as they swore allegiance to America. New citizens who would preserve, protect, and defend what was now their constitution
as much as it was for the President of the United States. Steve Wong, Anna, and I were in the bleachers, witnessing the naturalization of a sea of immigrants, their skins all the different colors of human nature. The sight was glorious and made the three of us emotional. Anna the most. She wept, her face pressed into my chest.
"It's so beautiful," she kept sobbing. "God, I love this country."
M-Dash's Home Depot co-workers who could get the time off showed up at my place with a lot of cheap American flags purchased with their employee discounts. Steve Wong set up a karaoke machine and we made M-Dash sing songs with America in the lyrics. American Woman, American Girl, Spirit of America by the Beach Boys is actually about a car, but we made him sing it anyway. We used the Radio Flyer wagon as an ice chest, and six of us planted the 48-star flag like we were the Marines on Iwo Jima, M-Dash being the guy in the very front. The party went long, until only the four of us were left watching the moon rise, listening to Old Glory flitter and flap on its pole. I had just opened another beer from the slosh of ice in the wagon when Anna took the can out of my hands. "Easy, baby," she said. "You're going to need all your capabilities just as soon as those two go home." An hour later, Steve Wong and M-Dash headed out, the new American citizen singing A Horse with No Name by the band America. As soon as Steve's car was out of the driveway, Anna took my hand, leading me to the backyard. She put cushions down on the soft grass, and we lay there, kissing. Then, well, you know, putting my capabilities to the test. Day 4. Anna runs whenever she can jam a few miles into 40 minutes, a habit she was going to force upon me. She took me to one of her routes, an uphill path that loops around Vista Point and back, and told me to get going. She would zip along ahead of me and meet me coming back down, knowing I never keep up with her. My exercise is an option-only affair. Occasionally, I'll ride my old 3-speed to Starbucks, or play a few rounds of frisbee golf. I used to belong to a league. This morning I was chuffing up the dirt road, Anna so far ahead that I didn't see her, my feet breaking in my new cross trainers, note to self, move up half a size. My blood was surging up and down my body in unfamiliar fury, so my shoulders and neck tensed up and my head pounded. When Anna came charging down from Vista Point, she was clapping her hands. "Atta baby," she called out, passing me. "Good first effort." I spun around to follow her. "My thighs are on fire." "They are rebelling," she called back over her shoulder. "In time, they will submit." Anna reorganized my kitchen when I was in the shower. She thought I kept my pans and lids in the wrong cupboards, and why was my flatware drawer so far from the dishwasher? I had no answer. "Let's get going. Can't be late for our first scuba lesson." The scuba school smelled of rubber wetsuits and the chlorinated pool. We filled out papers and were given workbooks to study, along with the schedule for our classroom sessions, as well as options for the date of our open water certification. Anna pointed to a Sunday 4 weeks away and reserved our berths on the boat on the spot. We went to the Viva Verde Salad Cafe for a lunch of salads made of salads with salad on the side, after which I wanted to go home for a nap. But Anna said she needed my help moving some stuff around her house, a chore she had been putting off. This was barely true, almost a lie. She actually wanted me to help her re-wallpaper her hallway and home office, which meant I had to move her computer, printer, scanners, and graphic equipment, then do her bidding all afternoon. I never made it home that evening. We had dinner in, vegetarian lasagna with vegetables on the side, and watched a movie on Netflix about smart women with idiot boyfriends. "Look, baby," Anna said, "this is about us." Then she cackled and reached into my pants without so much as kissing me. I either was the luckiest man in the world or was being played for a sucker. After Anna let me reach into her pants as well, I still wasn't sure which. Day 5. Anna had to work at her office. She employs 4 no-nonsense women and an intern who is an at-risk girl from high school. Last year, she landed a contract for doing the graphics for a textbook publisher. Steady work, but as boring as wallpapering for a living. I told her I was going home. Why? She asked. You got nothing to do today. I am going to get a run in, I said, making that up on the spur of the moment. Atta baby, she told me. I went home and did put on the cross trainers, then jogged around the neighborhood. Mr. Moore, a retired cop whose house shares my back fence, saw me running by and hollered out, "What the fuck got into you?" "A woman," I yelled back. And not only was that true, but I felt good saying it. When a man thinks of a lady and looks forward to telling her that he ran 40 minutes, well, partner, he's living in girlfriend territory. Yes, I had a girlfriend. A girlfriend changes a man from the shoes he exercises in right up to how he cuts his hair, which Anna did the very next day in front of my barber. Alterations I was due. Fooled by the adrenaline of romance, I ran farther than my body could stand. Anna called just as I had given up on a nap because my calves were as tight as beer cans. She told me to get over to her acupuncturist. She'd call to arrange an immediate treatment. The East Valley Wellness Oasis is in a mini-mall professional building with underground parking. Driving my VW bus, which has no power steering, around and around those descending circular ramps took physical effort. Figuring out the multiple elevators of the facility taxed my brain. When I finally found Office 606W, I filled in 5 pages of a wellness questionnaire, sitting beside a fountain that made more noise from its electric pump than from its cascading water element. "Do you accept the practice of visualization?" "Sure, why not?" "Are you open to guided meditation?" "I don't see how it could hurt." "Explain your reasons for seeking treatment. Please, be specific." "My girlfriend told me to bring you my tired, my poor, my balled-up leg muscles yearning to be freed." I handed in my answers and waited. Eventually, a guy in a white lab coat called my name and took me into a treatment room. As I stripped down to my skivvies, he read over my paperwork. "Anna says your legs are bothering you?" he asked. He'd been working on Anna for the last 3 years. "Yep," I said, "my calves, among other muscles in revolt." "According to this," he said, tapping my paperwork, "Anna's your girlfriend." "A new development," I told him. "Good luck with that. Lay on your stomach." When he put the needles in me, my whole body tingled, and my calves twitched uncontrollably. Before leaving the room, he hit play on an old CD boombox for my guided meditation. I heard a woman's voice tell me to clear my mind and think of a river. I sort of did that for half an hour, wanting to fall asleep, but couldn't because I had needles sticking in me. Anna was waiting for me at my house, having made us a dinner of leafy plants with seeds and rice the color of dirt. Afterward, she rubbed my legs so hard I winced. Later, she said she had not made love 5 nights in a row since college, but was going to give it a whirl. Day 6. She had set the alarm on her phone for 5:45 a.m. because she had to get a lot done. She made me get up too, allowing me a single cup of coffee, then made me put on my running clothes. "My calves still hurt," I told her. "Only because you are telling yourself they hurt," she said. "I don't want to run this morning," I complained. "Tough titties, baby." She threw my sweatpants at me. The morning was cold and misty. "Perfect for road work," she said. She forced me to imitate her 12-minute stretching routine right there in my driveway, setting a timer on her phone with a tone that binged every 30 seconds. There were 24 body positions I had to hold, each one stretching some sinew or muscle inside me, each one making me wince, cuss out loud, and get lightheaded. "Atta baby," she said. Then she explained the route we would take around my neighborhood, twice for her, once for me. Mr. Moore was getting his morning paper from his front lawn just as I was running by. "Was that your woman who ran by a minute ago?" he called to me. I was panting so hard I could only nod. "What the fuck she see in you?" A few minutes later, Anna lapped me, spanking my buttocks as she passed. Atta, baby! I was home and in the shower when she joined me. We kissed a lot and touched each other in our wonderful places. She instructed me on how to scrub her back and told me to come to her office at lunch so we could study our scuba workbook. I had yet to read the first few pages, but she had already completed half of it. When she had the time is beyond me. I spent the afternoon hanging around her office, answering multiple-choice questions about scuba equipment and its uses, scrolling through some real estate listings, I still dabble, and trying to amuse the women who were bent over their graphic work. No dice. All this while Anna took a long conference call with a client in Fort Worth, Texas, designed new title pages for a series of textbooks, proofread three projects, helped her at-risk intern with her geometry homework, reorganized a supply closet, and completed the second half of the scuba assignments. We had yet to take our first classroom session. Not that it mattered. We were the only students. We watched videos about the glorious underwater world, then got into the pool. We stood in the shallow end while Vin, our instructor, explained to us every piece of the self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. That took a long time, mostly because Anna had at least five questions for every bit of gear. Finally, Vin had us put the regulators in our mouths, drop to our knees so our heads were submerged, suck in the metallic-tasting pressurized air, and blow out bubbles. The class ended with us taking a water fitness test by swimming 10 laps. Anna went to the task like an Olympian and was out of the pool and drying off in a few minutes. I swam a languid breaststroke, finishing a distant second in a race of two. Afterward, we drove to the East Village Market Mall to meet Steve Wong and M-Dash at Ye Old Sweet Shop for milkshakes. Anna had a small cup of sugar-free, non-dairy yogurt with a dusting of real cinnamon. Sitting there, enjoying our treats, Anna tucked her hand in mine, a gesture of affection that did not go unnoticed. In her bed that night, Anna was going through her pre-sleep iPad scroll when I got a text from Steve Wong. S. Wong, you boffing A? I pinched out my reply. Moonwalker 7, your business? S. Wong, yes / no. Moonwalker 7, grimace. S. Wong, you insane? Moonwalker 7, jet plane taken off, golfer swinging his club, rocket ship, arrow in a target, arrow in a bow, 2 !, checkered flag, smirk. Then M-Dash joined the chain. Face of America. Scared face. Moonwalker 7. I was seduced. Face of America. When cooks fuck, the stew burns. Moonwalker 7. Who says that? The village shaman? Face of America. When coaches fuck, the team loses. Vince Lombardi. And so it went. Steve Wong and M-Dash saw no good coming out of the pairing of Anna and me. Too bad. That very night, Anna and I went at it like stew cooks in Green Bay, Wisconsin, hell-bent on pleasure. Smirk. Day 7. Should we have a chat about our relationship? That was me asking. I was standing in Anna's kitchenette, wrapped in only a towel after a shower, plunging her Swiss press coffee apparatus for my morning elixir. She had been up for an hour and a half and was already in her running togs. Luckily, my cross trainers were back at my place, so no marathon training for me. Do you want to have a chat about our relationship? She asked, cleaning up the few outstanding coffee grounds that had fallen onto her surgically spotless countertop. Are we an item? I asked. What do you think? She asked back. Do you think of me as your boyfriend? Do you think of me as your girlfriend? Is either one of us going to make a declarative statement? How should I know? I sat down and took a sip of coffee that was too strong. Can I have some milk for this? I asked. Do you think that gunk is good for you? She handed me a small bottle of non-preservative almond milk, the kind that has to be used up in only a few days, the kind that is sold as milk but is actually liquefied nuts. Could you buy real milk so I can have it in my coffee? Why are you so demanding? Is asking for milk a demand? She smiled and took my face in her hands. Do you think you're the man for me? She kissed me. I was about to make a declarative statement, but she sat on my lap and undid the towel I was wearing. She didn't get in her morning run. Days 8 through 14. Being Anna's boyfriend was like training to be a Navy SEAL while working full-time in an Amazon fulfillment center in the Oklahoma Panhandle in tornado season. Something was going on every moment of every day. My 2:30 naps were a thing of the past. I was exercising regularly, not just the morning jogs, but also swimming in scuba class, doing yoga stretches for what grew into a half hour, and joining Anna in a hot room spinning class that was so taxing, I upchucked. The number of errands we went on was maddening, and they never came from a to-do list or shopping helper app, but were all spur-of-the-moment, ad hoc, incessant. If unoccupied with work, working out, or working me over in the sack, Anna was making something, looking for something, asking to see what the store had in the back, driving to an estate sale across town, or going to Home Depot to ask Steve Wong about a belt sander for me, as the top of the redwood picnic table in my backyard needed smoothing. Every day, all day, I spent following her orders, which included precise driving instructions. Make the next left. Don't get off here. Take Webster Avenue. Why are you turning right now? Don't go past the school. It's almost 3 o'clock. The kids are just getting out. She organized a rock climbing demonstration for Steve Wong, M-Dash, and me, and a newly opened adventure superstore that had a climbing wall as well as an indoor rushing river to demonstrate whitewater canoeing and a skydiving chamber. A huge fan that blew straight up a silo with so much force it simulated free fall for helmeted customers. Need I say that in one evening the four of us did all of them? We were there until closing. Steve Wong and M-Dash felt like He-Men after a full day's work wearing those unisex aprons at Home Depot. I was exhausted, having been on Anna's overloaded schedule too long. I needed a nap. We had time for protein snacks at the energy stand at the front of the store when Anna left for the restroom.
What's it like? M-Dash asked.
What's what like? I said.
You and Anna, sitting in the tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G.
You holding up? Steve Wong asked. You look exhausted. Well, I did just go faux skydiving. M-Dash threw his uneaten half of a protein bar into the trash.
I used to look at you and think, that guy has figured it all out. He has a sweet little house with a nice backyard. He doesn't work for anyone but his own self. He could throw away his watch because he never has to be anywhere. To me, you were the America I hope to live in. Now, you count out to a boss lady. Alas.
Really? I said. Alas? Tell him that proverb you told me, Steve said. Oh, something else the village shaman taught you, I wondered.
Actually, the village English teacher, M-Dash said. To circle the globe, a ship needs only a sail, a wheel, a compass, and a clock.
Wise words in a landlocked nation, I said. M-Dash grew up in the sub-Sahara.
Anna is the compass, M-Dash explained. You are the clock, but you keeping time with her means you become unwound. Your hands are right only twice a day. We'll never know our longitude.
Are you sure Anna isn't the sail, I said? And why can't I be the wheel and Steve be the compass? I don't follow this analogy.
Let me put this into a language you can understand, Steve said. We are all like a TV show with diversity casting. African guy him, Asian guy me, mongrel Caucasoid you, strong, determined woman, Anna, who would never let a man define her. You and her pairing off is like a storyline from season 11 when the network is trying to keep us on the air.
I looked at M-Dash. Are you getting this pop culture metaphor?
The gist of it, I have cable.
The four of us, Steve explained,
are the perfect square. You taking to the sheets with Anna is going to misalign our geometry.
How?
She makes things happen in our lives. Look at us. It's nearly midnight, and we've been dangling and rowing and parachuting indoors. Stuff I'd never do on a school night. She's our catalyst.
You've used sailboats, TV shows, geometry, and chemistry to point out why I shouldn't see Anna, and I still don't buy it.
I predict tears, M-Dash said. For you, for Anna, for all of us. Tears shooting out of our eyes.
Look, I said, pushing away a protein brownie that actually tasted like a brownie. One of these things is going to happen between me and my girlfriend. Yes, girlfriend. I stole a look at Anna. She was far away chatting with an employee at a counter with a sign over it saying, Invest in adventure. One, we get married, have kids, and you are their godfathers. Two, we break up in a public display of hurt feelings and recriminations. Both of you will have to choose sides, remain pals with me, or go against the established rules of gender and stay friends with a woman. Three, she meets some other guy and dumps me. I become a melancholy loser, and do not say that's already what I am. Four, she and I part ways, amicably deciding to be friends, as seen on TV. What memories remain are those of pseudo-rock climbing et al., and the finest sex I've had in a lifetime. We can handle any of those fates because we are all big boy grown-ups. And admit it, if Anna wanted to make out with you like she does with me, you'd be all for it. And you'd be the one predicting tears, Steve Wong said. Just then Anna returned, waving a thick and glossy color brochure, a smile on her face. Hey guys, she said. We are going to Antarctica.
Day 15.
We'll need the correct gear. Anna was dipping a fresh Rainbow Tea Company tea bag into a mug of hot water. She was in her running clothes as I was putting on my cross trainers. Long johns, parkas and shells, fleece pullovers, waterproof boots, walking sticks, gloves, I added, hats.
The trip to Antarctica was 3 months, many time zones, and thousands of miles away, and Anna was already in full planning mode.
Won't it be summer at the South Pole, I asked?
We won't make it to the pole. To the Antarctic Circle, maybe, but only if the weather and sea cooperate. Still going to be a lot of ice and wind.
We went outside to do 45 minutes of stretching on my front lawn, getting our downward dogs and cobras wet from the morning dew. Bing, the timer went off, and I bent over, trying to touch my forehead to my kneecaps. Fat chance. Anna was able to fold herself up like a card table.
You do realize, she said, the Apollo astronauts went to Antarctica to study the volcanoes?
Anna knew of my Jones for all things spaceman related, but she didn't know just how well I knew that stuff. They trained in Iceland, young lady. If any astronauts went to the South Pole, it was long after they retired from altering the course of human destiny by cheating death in NASA rocket ships.
Bing!
I tried to reach out and grab my ankles, setting my poor calves off fire.
Going to see penguins and whales and science stations, Anna said. And B-15K.
What is B-15K?
An iceberg the size of Manhattan. So large it's tracked via satellite, broke off from the Ross Ice Shelf in 2003, and is independently moving counterclockwise around Antarctica. If the weather holds, we can book a chopper and land on it.
Bing. That was the final exercise. She took off running. I tried to keep up with her, but no way that was going to happen. Not with her all pumped up about B-15K. As I trotted by Mr. Moore's house, he was just getting into his car, a travel mug of coffee in his hand.
That girlfriend of yours ran by a second ago. She was hauling ass.
After showers and a breakfast of avocado on toasted spelt bread, Anna took that belt sander she bought from Steve Wong and started grinding down my picnic table. I joined her with some sandpaper of my own.
After you take it down to the grain, you'll need to repaint this. Do you have paint?
I did.
You should have this done by tonight, then come to my place. We'll have dinner and sex.
Fine by me, is how I felt. I have to go to work now. Before leaving, she pointed out other wooden objects that needed sanding and paint as well. A bench, the back door to my kitchen, and the old shed where I keep my lawn toys and sports equipment. I spent the rest of the day on the work detail. I was sweaty, dusty, and splattered with paint when Anna texted me. Anna Graphic Control. Dinner in 15. I got over to her place in half an hour, but needed a shower before dinner. We ate in the living room, huge bowls of Vietnamese pho, watching two episodes of Our Frozen Earth on Blu-ray. For over 3 hours, we learned all about the chinstrap penguins and crab-eater seals that live only in guess which part of our planet. I fell asleep before we got around to any sex. Day 16. Anna had scheduled an early morning scuba class without telling me. Vin had us in full wetsuits, the tanks, the weight belts, everything, sitting on our knees at the bottom of the deep end of the pool. We had to remove every piece of the scuba apparatus, including our masks, hold our breath, then put it all back on again. Afterward, Vin said I was behind in my workbook and had better get cracking. Why haven't you finished the workbook? Anna wanted to know. A date with a belt sander took up my time. Driving home, I felt a chalky tickle in the back of my throat, like I was getting a cold. Don't say you were getting a cold, Anna said. If you tell yourself you are sick, you allow yourself to be sick. Her phone went off, and she took the call hands-free. It was one of her clients in Fort Worth. A fellow named Ricardo told jokes about color templates, making Anna laugh as she pulled into my driveway. She stayed in the car to finish that call. I went inside. We have to go to Fort Worth, she announced when she finally came into my kitchen. I was making chicken noodle soup from a packet. Why? I asked. I have to handhold Ricardo through a presentation. That is not soup, by the way. That's a sack full of sodium. I'm allowing myself to be sick. Soup will help. That shit will kill you. I have to go to Fort Worth with you? Why not? You aren't doing anything. We'll stay overnight and see the sights. Of Fort Worth? It will be an adventure. My nose is running, and I feel like a hive of bees are swarming in my head. You can make it stop if you stop saying such things, she said. In response, I sneezed, coughed, and blew my nose into a tissue. Anna just shook her head. Day 17. Here are the sights I saw in Fort Worth. The huge airport, jammed with so many travelers it seemed like the Texan economy had collapsed and the population was fleeing. Baggage claim, under renovation and therefore a place of chaos and borderline fistfights. Anna had checked 3 suitcases, which were among the last to come shooting down the chute. A bus, painted all around in huge letters that said, Pony car, pony car, pony car. Pony car was a new travel option in competition with Uber and their rental companies. Anna had a voucher for a free weekend, why I don't know. The bus took us to a lot filled with tiny cars, also painted with the pony car logo. I have no idea where pony cars are manufactured, but they are clearly designed for small people. The two of us and our luggage had to be squeezed into a vehicle sized to fit the two of us and one-third of our luggage. The DFW Sun Garden Hotel. Not so much a hotel as a collection of efficiency suites and vending machines meant for business travelers with limited expense accounts. Once we were in our little room, I lay down. Anna changed into professional clothes while she was on her cell phone with Ricardo. She waved goodbye to me and was out the door, trailing her professional rolling bag behind her. In a fog due to my lousy health, I could not get the TV to work. The cable system had a menu unfamiliar to me. All I could get on screen was the Sun Garden Hotel channel, which showed the glories and wonders of all the Sun Garden hotels in the world. New branches were opening soon in Evansville, Indiana, Urbana, Illinois, and Frankfurt, Germany. I could make no sense of the phone system either. I kept getting the same main voice menu. I was hungry, so I dragged myself down to the lobby to shop in the vending machines. The machines were in a separate little room shared with a small buffet table that held bowls of apples and dispensers of breakfast cereals. I took some of each. One of the vending machines sold pizza by the slice. Another offered toiletries, including a few cold remedies. After four tries at getting the machine to accept my crinkled $20 bill, I bought some capsules, some pills, a few single-dose liquids, and something in a small bottle called Boost Blaster that bragged of its megadose of antioxidants, enzymes, and whatever good stuff is in Swiss chard and certain fish. Back up in the room, I made a cocktail of two of every purchase, tearing off the safety foil, figuring out the childproof caps, and chugging down the Boost Blaster in one pull. Day 18. I woke up with no idea where I was. I heard a shower running. I saw a crack of light from under a door and a stack of textbooks on the nightstand. The bathroom door flew open in a flash of illuminated steam. He's alive! Anna was naked, drying herself off. She had already been out for a run. Am I? My cold was no better, not at all. The only new feeling I had was wooziness.
You took all this stuff?
She waved at the small desk littered with the debris left over from my self-medication. Still sick, I said, in feeble self-defense.
Saying you are still sick makes you still sick.
I feel so rotten. Your logic actually makes sense.
You missed it, baby. Last night we went out for organic Mexican food. It was Ricardo's birthday. There were about 40 of us and a piñata. After we all went to a racetrack and drove miniature hot rods, I called you, texted you, but nothing.
I grabbed my phone. Between 6 p.m. and 1:30 in the morning, Anagraphic Control had called and texted me 33 times. Anna started getting dressed.
You better pack. Gotta check out of here. Then go to Ricardo's office for a meeting, to the airport from there.
Anna piloted the pony car to an industrial park somewhere in Fort Worth. I sat in the reception area, feeling horrible, blowing my nose again and again, trying to focus on a book about astronaut Walt Cunningham on my Kobo digital reader, but I was just too foggy. I played a game on my phone called 101, answering true-false and multiple-choice questions. True or false? President Woodrow Wilson used a typewriter in the White House.
True. He hunted and pecked a speech on a Hammond typomatic, hoping to drum up support for World War I.
After a long sit, I needed some air. So I took a slow walk around the industrial park. Every building looked the same, and I got lost. I found my way back when, luckily, I spotted a parked pony car that turned out to be ours. Anna was there, cooling her heels with her clients, waiting for me.
Where were you?
Seeing the sights, I said. She introduced me to Ricardo and 13 other textbook executives. I shook hands with none of them. I had a cold, you see. Returning the pony car was as effortless as promised, but the courtesy bus to the airline terminal took forever to show up. To make our plane, Anna and I had to run through the DFW airport like two characters from a movie that was about either wacky lovers on a vacation or federal agents trying to stop a terrorist attack. We did make the plane, but not in time to get seats together. Anna sat up front. I was way in the back. My clogged ears were killing me on departure and hurt even more hours later on descent. On the way to my house, she stopped at a liquor store for a small bottle of brandy. She had me drink a large shot of the booze, then put me into bed with a pillow tuck and a kiss on my forehead. Days 19 and 20. I was ill, pure and simple, with bed rest and liquids being the only remedies, as has been the case with colds since the first Neanderthal came down with the sniffles. Anna, though, had her own ideas. For 2 days, she was on a mission to cure me sooner rather than gradually. She had me sit naked in a chair with my feet in a tub of cold water. She wired up my limbs to something akin to an EKG machine, made me take off any metal I was wearing, which was none, then flipped a switch. I felt nothing. But in time, the water around my feet turned first murky, then brown, and then began to congeal until the tub looked like the most unappetizing jello mold imaginable. The goop was so thick that pulling my bare feet out was like extracting myself from swamp mud, and the stuff stank. "That's the bad juju coming out of you," Anna said as she flushed the slop down the toilet. "Out of my feet?" I asked. "Yes, it's proven. The bad food you eat, the body poisons and fats, they leach out of your feet."
"Can I go back to bed now?"
"Just until your steam shower."
"I don't have a steam shower."
"You will."
Anna installed a series of plastic curtains in my shower with a portable steam maker set on high. I sat in it on a footstool, sweating, until I was able to polish off 3 big bottles of weak tea of some kind. This took some time, as the tea tasted like gutter water, and a man's bladder can only hold so much gutter water. An exercise bicycle was delivered. Anna made me ride it every hour and a half for exactly 12 minutes, until I had worked up a sweat to prove I had raised my body temperature.
"This is to cook out the mucus and such," she said.
For 3 meals in a row, she fed me bowls of watery stew with chunks of beets and celery. She had me do 1-hour slow stretch sessions from her iPad, but I had to move exactly as did the instructor on the video. She plugged in this thing, the size of an electric bar of soap, that made a humming sound and vibration, a bit of homemade medicine with Russian lettering on the box. She had me lie naked on the floor and rubbed my entire body, both sides, with whatever that thing was. The Kami machine made different sounds over different parts of my body.
"Atta baby," Anna said. "We're getting to it now."
Without telling her, I chugged some NyQuil and chewed up a few Sudafeds just before I crawled back into my bed to disappear into the land of Nod. Day 21. I felt better in the morning. My sheets were so damp with my night sweats I could have wrung them out like a chamois. Anna had left a note taped to my percolator. "Left you sleeping deep and silent. I like you like that. You will no longer be ill if you finish the soup in the refrigerator. Drink it cold in the morning, hot at lunch. Do the extra bike twice before noon, and take an hour for the stretch routine on the link I emailed you. And re-steam until you've downed 3 bottles of distilled water. Leach that sodium. A." I was alone in my house, on my own terms, so I immediately ignored Anna's instructions. I had coffee with hot milk. I read an actual print copy of the Times, not the online version, which Anna preferred because newsprint paper was a sin against the earth, regardless of my recycling. I treated myself to a nutritious breakfast of eggs with fried slices of linguiça, a Portuguese sausage, a banana, a strawberry Pop-Tart, papaya juice from a carton, and a large bowl of Cocoa Puffs. I did not do any stretching. I did not get on the stationary bike, nor did I go into the plastic steam stall. I did not open her email link, thus stretched not a whit. Instead, I spent the morning doing laundry, 4 loads, including the bed sheets. I played my mixtape CDs and sang along. I reveled in obeying not a single one of Anna's commands. I lived the best life imaginable. Which meant I had answered the question Anna had put to me 2 weeks earlier. No. I did not think I was the man for her. When she called to ask how I was, I confessed to ignoring her instructions. I also said that I felt healthy, rested, and like myself. And despite how wonderful I thought she was, and what a dope I am, and blah-diddy-blah-blah-diddy-blah, before I could muster the vocabulary to actually break up with her, Anna did it for me,
You're not the man for me, baby.
There was not a smidgen of rancor in her voice, neither judgment nor disappointment. She said it straight out of her face in a way I couldn't.
I've known it for a while, Anna said, chuckling. I was wearing you down. Would have destroyed you over time.
When were you going to let me off your hook, I asked.
If you hadn't backed out by Friday morning, we'd have had the talk then.
Why Friday morning?
Because Friday night I'm going back to Fort Worth. Ricardo is taking me hot air ballooning.
A bit of my man pride had me instantly hoping that this Ricardo fella would not be the man for Anna either. He wasn't. Anna never told me why. For the record, I did get my scuba certificate. Anna and I joined Vin and a dozen other divers offshore in the kelp beds. We breathed underwater, swimming through what looked like a tall forest of sea trees. There's a great picture of Anna and me on board afterward, our wet-suited arms around each other and big smiles on our cold, wet faces. We leave for Antarctica next week. Anna arranged a big shopping spree, seeing to it that we have all the necessary gear. She spent extra time with M-Dash, making sure he was going to have enough layers to stay warm. He's never been to a place cold enough for chin straps and crab eaters. Antarctic Circle, make way, I hollered, modeling my green parka and shell. Anna laughed. We'll fly to Lima, Peru, then change planes for Punta Arenas, Chile, where we'll board a boat to make the crossing from South America to the old science station at Port Lockroy, our first stop. The seas in the Drake Passage could get pretty rough and tumble, they say, but with a strong sail, a firm wheel, a true compass, and a reliable clock, our ship will journey south, bound for the Antarctic Circle, B-15K, and adventure galore.
Christmas Eve, 1953. Virgil Buell didn't close the shop until nearly dinner time, when a light snow began falling. The road back home was slick and getting slicker, so he drove slowly, wonderfully easy to do in the Plymouth with the Power Flight automatic transmission. No clutch, no shifting, an engineering marvel. Skidding off the icy road and getting stuck in the snow would be a disaster tonight. In the Plymouth's trunk were the treasures due in the morning from Santa, kept hidden and undiscovered there since the kids had declared their wishes weeks ago. Those presents had to be under the tree in a few hours, and transferring them from the trunk of a snowbound car to the cab of a tow truck would alter Christmas Eve horribly. The drive home took longer than usual, sure, but the length of the trip did not bother Virgil. The cold was what he hated. Power flight or not, he often cursed the folks at Plymouth who were unable to build a car with a heater worth a damn. By the time he slowly pulled up to the house and the yellow spread of the headlamps played on the screen of the back porch and there was the hush of tires coming to a stop on the gravel drive, he was aching slightly from the cold. Virgil had to be extra careful not to slip on the front walkway, as he had done too many times before. But he still got inside the house as fast as a working man could. As he stamped the snow off his overshoes and hung up his layers of warm clothing, Virgil's body softened in the warmth pumping up from the cellar through the grates. After buying the house, he self-installed a furnace that was far oversized for the modest home. He put in, too, a beast of a hot water heater, a commercial unit that never, ever ran out of the liquid heaven that allowed for the kids' baths and his own long showers. The winter fuel bills were worth the comfort, as was the price of 2 cords of firewood every winter. A fire was going in the family room. He had taught Davy how to build one by stacking the wood the way he did his toy Lincoln Logs, like a square house around the kindling, never a pyramid. The kid now viewed making the fire as his sacred duty. Come the first frosts of November, the Buell home was the warmest place for miles and miles.
Dad! Davy came running from the kitchen. Our plan is working great. Jill is completely fooled.
Good news, big man, Virgil said, giving his boy the secret handshake known in the entire world only by the two of them.
I told her we'd write the Santa letters after dinner, then lay out some snacks, just like you did with me when I was little.
Davy was turning 11 in January. Jill was setting the kitchen table, her specialty being the straightening of napkins and silverware.
My daddy is home, hooray, hooray, the six-year-old said, lining up the last of the spoons.
He is? Dolores Gomez Buell asked, standing as she cooked at the stove, baby Connie straddling the nooks of her elbow and hip. Virgil gave each of the women in his life a kiss.
So he is, Dale said, picking him back,
then dishing fried potatoes with onions onto a platter and getting it to the table. Davy brought his father a can of beer from the new huge Kelvinator and ceremonially levered the two opposing openings in the top with a church key, another sacred duty. Dinner time with the family Buell was a show. Davy was in and out of his chair. The kid never sat through a meal. Connie squirmed in her mother's lap, content with a spoon she worked around in her mouth or banged on the table. Dell cut food for the kids, wiped up spills, placed bits of mashed-up potato into Connie's mouth, and occasionally had a bite herself. Virgil ate slowly, never repeating a bite of any one food, but working his fork around his plate in a circle as he enjoyed the theater that was his family.
"I'm telling you, Santa needs only three cookies," Davy was explaining for Jill's sake the facts surrounding the evening's expected visitor. "And he never finishes a whole glass of milk. He's got so much to do. Right, Dad?"
"So I hear," Virgil gave his son a wink that Davy tried to return, but he could only scrunch up the one side of his face to force one eye closed.
"Anyway, everyone leaves him the same snack."
"Everyone?" Jill asked.
"Everyone. I can't figure out when he comes. When does he show up?"
Jill needed to know.
"Not at all if you don't touch your dinner," Dell tapped Jill's plate with her fork and separated some of her potato from her meat. "Bites get Santa here sooner."
"Right when we all go to bed?" Jill asked. "We have to be sleeping, right?"
"Could be any time between bedtime and when we wake up."
Davy had answers for every one of his sister's queries. Since he had figured out the deal with Santa over the summer, Davy had assigned himself the task of keeping his little sister a believer.
"That could be hours. If his milk sits out too long, it'll go bad. He can make it cold with just a touch. He just sticks his finger in a glass of warm milk and does a whooshy thing and boom, cold milk."
Jill found that fact amazing. "He must drink a lot of milk." After dinner, Virgil and the kids did KP, Jill standing on a chair over the sink, drying the forks and spoons one by one, while Dell was upstairs putting the baby down and grabbing a short, much-needed nap. Davy opened his father's final can of beer for the night and set it on the telephone table right beside what was called Daddy's chair in the front room by the fire. Once Virgil was sitting and sipping, Davy and Jill lay in front of the phonograph and played Christmas records. With the room lights off, the tree threw colored magic onto the walls. Jill found Virgil's lap while her brother played the Rudolph record over and over until they knew all the words and started adding their own. "Had a very shiny nose.
Like a light bulb.
Used to laugh and call him names.
Hey, not had.
You'll go down in history.
And arithmetic."
Dell came downstairs, laughing. "What would you goofballs make of Joy to the World?" She took a sip from Virgil's beer before sitting in her corner of the sofa, tapping a cigarette from her leather case with a snap clasp, and lighting it with matches from the ashtray set beside the phone.
"Davy, poke that log a bit, would you?" Virgil said.
Jill perked up. "Let me poke the fire. After me. And don't worry, Santa's boots are fireproof."
"I know, I know."
After Jill took her turn stabbing the fire, Dell sent the kids upstairs to change into their PJs. Virgil finished his beer, then went to the hall closet to pull out the portable Remington typewriter. Dolores had bought the machine brand new for Virgil when he was in the Army hospital on Long Island, New York. He had typed letters to her with his one good hand, until the therapists taught him to use what he called 5.5-finger touch typing. He took the writing machine out of its case on the low coffee table and rolled in 2 sheets of paper, one on top of the other, always